So I think we can start this morning's talk. And yesterday I spent the time answering questions. So today we can give a proper Dhamma talk. And the subject I wanted to do yesterday but never got around to was again important for everybody to be able to calm the mind, to make it still and to make it bright. I did mention the last couple of mornings very deep talks on jhanas and deep insight, which is very nice for many of you, but for most of you it may be a bit too far down the track, and we want to find out just how we can still just stay with the breath and have a bit of peace and quiet just for a few minutes before we look forward to the really important big stuff of meditation. But nevertheless, I like to mention the deep meditations and the insights because it puts everything in perspective. So you get the big picture, so you realize that what you're doing now, it has meaning in the context of the big picture of deep meditation and enlightenment. But part of being able to calm the mind, I mean, you've had a lot of practice already, and sometimes, despite all the instructions, that sometimes the mind wanders off, sometimes it goes into silly thoughts, sometimes it just worries about things which probably won't happen anyway, sometimes it gets afraid, sometimes it falls asleep. And it's so frustrating when you try to meditate dealing with all of these problems and you think you've dealt with it and it comes back again. So many of the skills in meditation are learning how to deal with those hindrances of meditation. And I've already mentioned one way of dealing with those hindrances is focusing on this present moment, making sure that you stay in the here and now, because nearly all of the distractions and the hindrances of the mind always live in the past and the future. So I'm reinforcing now, please be present. Forget about what's happening this afternoon. Let alone forget about what's happening when you leave here. Already people are asking me, yes, but what do I do when I meditate back home? You're not home yet. That's a long time in the distant future. You may never get back home. You may be enlightened this afternoon. You know what they say, if you become an enlightened man or woman, you have to become a monk or nun. There's no other choice except die. So who knows, you may never get back to work. So don't keep worrying about the future. Look, so much of our life, you know, we're never here. We spend it in the future planning what we're going to do next. And when we get to that next point, we're planning what we're going to do sometime in the further future. We're always many steps ahead of ourselves. So at lunchtime today, I'm going to ask you to do the present moment awareness practice of the one spoon at a time practice, which is this. Whenever you eat, you pick up a spoon or maybe a fork of food, maybe a spoon of food, you bring it up to your mouth and you put it in the mouth and you chew it, taste it and swallow it. And only when you've swallowed it do you even think what you're going to eat next. But what usually happens with people, I've seen you as you're eating your food, you've got one morsel in your food chewing. You've got another one waiting on the spoon in line. You've got a heap, which is number three in line. And then you're also fiddling around and wondering what the fourth one is going to be. You're at least three or four spoonfuls ahead of yourself. Why do you do that? If you do that, if you're not tasting the food in your mouth right now, no wonder you get indigestion, because you need to be mindful of the food and the taste of the food for the saliva and all the other secretions of the body to come out so the food is properly digested. But if you're not paying any attention to the food, at least not the food in your mouth, because you're paying attention to what you're going to eat three or four spoons ahead of yourself, then you don't get good digestion. And number two, it means you're not in the present moment. You're always worrying about what you're going to have next, not what you're having now. So you can even do this in the eating, one spoon at a time. And if you like to help each other, if you see the person sitting next to you is chewing and they've got a a spoon of food in their bowl, sort of, you know, just tap the spoon or turn it over so it falls back on the plate. Help them be in the moment. But I say that now, and most of you will forget by lunchtime. So how on earth can we have these instructions and make them work when they go into our mind and they just get lost somewhere in the labyrinth of our brain? And there is a good way of remembering these things, because mindfulness, real mindfulness, is not just overseeing the mind, it's also remembering the instructions. And so there's a way that we can practice mindfulness. So you put the instructions in your mind and you remember them. Not in a way of carrying them like some burden. I must remember to do this, I must remember to do this, I must remember to do this. But in a way which the instructions will come up when they're needed. And that is what I call programming your mindfulness. Now, I've taught a few people this technique during the interviews, but I did promise to tell everybody in this talk how to program your mindfulness. And what you do is, when you are beginning your meditation, you know, you've got yourself nice and comfortable, you're about to start, give your mindfulness some instructions. Tell it what you want it to do. Because your mind is like a friend who wants to help you but doesn't know what you want it to do. And because of that, it's so confused, it hasn't got good instructions, it means you never get very far in your meditation. So at the very beginning of the meditation, you can tell your mind, I want to stay in the present moment. Instruct your mindfulness. If you see any thoughts of the past coming up, stop it, it's not my business. If there's any thought of the future coming up, stop, it's not my business. And I usually program my mindfulness by repeating the instructions 3 times. I try to keep it simple, because you know what it's like at work. If you explain a task to one of the people who you're managing, and you make that task so complicated, they just don't understand what you want them to do. So you have to make your instructions what we call idiot-proof. I think you know what I mean. Simple and clear. And if you do that, you do it 3 times and then just forget about it. And what happens is, it's like one of these antiviruses you put in your computer. It means it sits in there somewhere. We don't know where it actually sits. But when it's needed, when a trigger comes, such as you start thinking of your past, straight away the idea comes into the mind. No, I will not think of the past. Or an idea of the future comes up. No. Automatically, the instruction comes up. No, I will stay in the present moment. I won't think of the future. You actually put those instructions in. And if you listen to it very mindfully, in other words, you pay full attention, you will find those instructions go deep inside your subconscious. And when they're needed, they will come out and do the work for you. So you won't always need to keep remembering, I must be in the present moment, I must be in the present moment. Come on, stupid, present moment, present moment, present moment. And you don't forget either. If you want to try experimenting with programming mindfulness, this evening, when you go to bed, when you're laying down there just before you go to sleep, tell yourself, I will wake up at 5 minutes to 5. I will wake up at 5 minutes to 5. I will wake up at 5 minutes to 5. Everyone else in your dormitory wakes up at 5. But you tell yourself, I will wake up 5 minutes to 5. Clearly, paying full attention, and very simple instructions. And you will find, to your surprise, your eyes will open up early in the morning, you haven't heard any bell, say, what time is it? And you look at your clock, it'll be 1 or 2 minutes either side of 5 to 5. The first time I tried that on a meditation retreat, it was amazing just how well it worked. And I kept my alarm clock 5 minutes later, just in case. But it worked perfectly well. And it really showed me just what this programming of mindfulness actually can do. To the point that you don't really need alarm clocks. You can tell yourself what time you want to wake up in the morning. If you've got to catch a plane to go somewhere, and you have to get up earlier than usual, you just tell yourself, I have to wake up at 3 a.m. I will wake up at 3 a.m. I will wake up at 3 a.m. You don't have to worry. You don't have to keep waking up in the middle of the night looking at your clock. Only 1 o'clock. Only 1:05. You just tell yourself that, and there's a biological clock inside your brain. You're given instructions, and you will wake up. It's a great way of not having to worry about things. I do that in my life as a monk, as an abbot, as a spiritual director of many Buddhist societies. Sometimes I have to make a telephone call. Will you call me at 3 p.m. tomorrow afternoon? Someone asked me. And instead of writing it down on a piece of paper, instead of tying a piece of string around my finger, that's sometimes what they do in the West. Tie a bit of string around the finger to remember that you've got to do something. But then you do that and you've got the string in the afternoon and said, what am I supposed to do? I know the string is there for something, but you still can't remember. But what I do is I just tell myself I'm quiet. I pay attention at 3 p.m. this afternoon. I must call my monastery. At 3 p.m. this afternoon, I must call my monastery. At 3 p.m. this afternoon, I must call my monastery. And I listen to myself say those things with full awareness, and I just totally forget about it. And at 3 o'clock, around that time, a thought comes in my mind. Yeah, I've got to ring my monastery. Where does that thought come from? I put it in there. I programmed it. And it works so beautifully well. So, if you have any problems in your meditation, in other words, you've got what I call your worst hindrance, then program your mindfulness to look out for that. I call this an adaption of programming mindfulness, the simile of my snake. And I got this simile when I was in monk in Thailand, and in those days we were very, very, very poor. So poor that sometimes I didn't have any sandals. When you had these simple sandals and they started to wear out, you tried to repair them. But because of the harshness of the climate and it was wet and muddy, the sandals, they very quickly just broke. So a lot of the time you had to go barefoot everywhere. And also, we had flashlights, but there was no batteries. I still remember once going to Ajahn Chah's hut and saying, look, my flashlight is really totally gone. There's no batteries left. Can I have some batteries? And he looked at me and he was very sad. He said, we haven't got any batteries. No one's got any. We've run out. Because good monks don't ask for things, and the monastery was quite poor in those days. So there, with no shoes and no batteries, you had to walk through the jungles. And especially at night time, after the evening service, with some chanting, meditation, and maybe a talk, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you had to walk back from the hall to your hut, knowing that there were snakes slithering on the floor, knowing that there were centipedes and scorpions and many other things which will bite you and maybe cause your great sickness or death. And there was no shoes and no flashlight. That was scary. So what did I do? Why did I never get bitten? Because when I left that hall in the evening, I knew there were snakes around. And so from the time I started walking barefoot without a flashlight, I was on the lookout for them. I'd program my mindfulness. If you see a dark shape across the path, it could be a shadow of a tree, it could be a stick, and it could be a snake. And so because I was on the lookout, I wasn't thinking about what I was going to do tomorrow. I wasn't dreaming about some fantasy when I was walking back. I was totally mindful and aware of shapes across the path. And if I saw a dark shape, I'd jump over it or try and go another path. And because I was always on the lookout for that snake, I never got bitten. And that simile I've used for meditation. You may have your so-called snake in meditation. Sloth and torpor. Or restless and thinking about your family, thinking this, thinking that, thinking whatever. Whatever is the hindrance which has stopped you getting peaceful most of all, that is your snake, which has bitten you so many times. So what you do, at the beginning of the meditation, search sloth and torpor. You tell yourself, sloth and torpor is out there on the path of my meditation. I know it's out there somewhere, slithering in the dark spaces of my mind. I am going to be on the lookout for that. And when you program your mindfulness to be on the lookout for things like sloth and torpor, you come to what we call the fork in the path of meditation. You see it. Sloth and torpor is just ahead. But there's another way, a fork. You can take another path, but only if you are really on the lookout for sloth and torpor, for dullness. And the only way you can do that is by programming your mindfulness. So when sloth and torpor is just in front of you, you can jump over it or take another path so it never catches you. And so by programming your mindfulness that way, you have a great advantage. You don't waste so much time always being caught by the same hindrances again and again and again. And also you don't have to get tense worrying about these things. You program the mindfulness in the beginning by repeating the instructions 3 times, and then you find it works. And that is a very powerful method for when you get deeper into the meditation. Because when you get deeper into the meditation, especially, for example, when you're seeing these beautiful lights, the problem is when you try and do something, when you're seeing a light, a beautiful nimitta in the mind, you always disturb it. So people wonder, what can I do? If I leave it alone, it vanishes. If I do something, it vanishes. You know, there's a problem there, and how can I interfere with the process of my mind to get rid of the hindrance of excitement or, say, fear? For example, you see a beautiful light, you get excited. You say, I shouldn't be excited. And that disturbs your mind even more than the excitement. But there is a way of doing it. And this is, again, the programming of your mindfulness. So if you're a meditator who often sees lights in the mind when you're meditating, and if you think that this meditation you're going to do next, it's likely, it's a good chance, that you might see a nimitta, then you program your mindfulness at the beginning, giving yourself an instruction. If I see that beautiful light, I will not become excited. If I see that light, I will not become excited. If I see that light, I will not become excited. Always repeat it 3 times. And then you forget it, and then you go watching the breath, the present moment awareness, or whatever you do. And then you'll find as you're meditating, you'd have forgotten the instructions that have got in your subconscious, not in your conscious mind. And when it comes to, the light comes up, your old habit of getting excited will be about to come up, and something in your mind will say automatically, don't get excited. And you know where that came from. You put that instruction in maybe 20 minutes earlier, and when it was ready, it just comes up automatically without you needing to do anything. You're not thinking. The instruction comes up, don't be excited. And it means you're not excited, nor are you disturbed, and you can get deeper into the meditations. You can also use that technique at home in your daily life. I know it's the nature of marriages. You can tell how long a person's been married by the way the husband and wife talks to one another. And you know what it's like, that people just say all these mean things to each other. And you don't want to say that, but it just becomes a bad habit. And you know, that's a very terrible habit in marriage, because everybody, you're always finding fault with each other, teasing each other, you know, prodding each other. And that's not very nice to have a relationship like that. So how can you stop that? And I tell their husbands, look, when you're at the office, before you leave home, in your office chair, close your eyes and you program your mindfulness. I will say something nice to my wife. I will say something nice to my wife. I will say something nice to my wife. You put it in your subconscious. And then you get home and your wife says, oh, you're late again. And then you're about to say something mean to her back, because that's what usually happens. It's like a tennis match. One mean thing, another mean thing, and then you just see who wins. You're about to say one mean thing, and that's your old habit. But the program of programming mindfulness comes up, and you think, no, I'm going to say something nice. And you say, oh, but I really rushed to see you, darling, because I really love being with you. Or something nice. And it's amazing, just because you program the mindfulness, the old habits actually change. I've used that for people who are addicted to smoking, and they're trying to give up. But what happens is, they're giving up, but sometimes they've given up for many, many days. And because, you know, they're not very aware or mindful, sometimes the cigarette's in their mouth before they realize they've done anything. It's, you know, just habits, that's all it is. So I tell them, program your mindfulness again. Just say to yourself, when I pick up that cigarette, I'll put it down again. When I pick up the cigarette, I'll put it down again. When I pick up that cigarette, I'll put it down again. Tell yourself that very clearly, and then forget about it. And then it happens. You know, they get these old habits, they see a cigarette, they're about to pick it up, and usually it would go right in their mouth and be lit before they become mindful. But now they pick it up, and the instruction is in there, in the mind somewhere. Now it's triggered, you hear it, I'll put it down again. And you stop. So the program of mindfulness is just simple, same as conditioning, hypnosis. It actually works, and it's great to be able to use for your meditation, especially the deeper meditations. So again, to sum up, find out your deepest hindrance, or your worst hindrance. We only do one at a time, because if you put too many programs in your mind at the same time, so you're sitting here, now I must be in the present moment, I must be in the present moment, I must be in the present moment, I also must be silent, I must be silent, I must be silent, and I can't go thinking, and I also must. And if you give too many instructions like that, it's so complicated. It's just like somebody at work giving you so many instructions, you just can't remember the first one when you've heard the last one. So keep it simple, and you'll find it actually does work. And it shows you some other aspect of mindfulness. Mindfulness is not just being aware, it's also remembering the instructions, what you're supposed to be doing, what you're supposed to be stopping and letting go of. I know this is a cheeky example, but I love this little example. It's just like this wealthy lady who lives, you know, in a very big mansion somewhere in the Klang Valley. She comes to one of my talks one evening here at Chaitawan Monastery. But before she leaves, she tells her gatekeeper, because she's got like a guard in the gate of her house, she tells the guard, I've heard there are burglars in this area, and they're targeting rich mansions like mine. Please be mindful of burglars, you tell the guard. And then the woman, having instructed the guard, comes to the temple, hears a wonderful talk, very inspired, and when she goes home, she finds out the burglars have been in her house. And she tells the gatekeeper, I told you to be mindful, and my house has been robbed. And the gatekeeper said, but madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noticed them carrying your jewellery out, and I noted, jewellery going out, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I saw them going in with the safe cracker going in, safe cracker. I saw the safe going out, I noted the safe going out, the safe. I was perfectly mindful, madam. Now, would that be a wise guard? Obviously not, because mindfulness is not just being aware, it's remembering the instructions. And this is actually how you put those instructions in. You program at the beginning. And if you try and put those instructions in the middle, you disturb everything. And that way the mindfulness actually does the job. One of the great instructions is to let go of things. We meditate to let go, not to attain things. And so in the middle of the meditation, when you're trying to think, oh, I'm getting somewhere now, mindfulness gets in stupid. You're not trying to get anything, okay? You're trying to be peaceful, to be still, not wanting to let go. And then mindfulness does its job. Which is why when the monks of the forest tradition, whenever they would mention mindfulness, sati, they would also mention panya as well. They would always call it sati panya, mindfulness together with wisdom, mindfulness together with wisdom, mindfulness together with wisdom. And that's actually what it meant, which meant your mindfulness and wisdom would actually manage to take you deep into the meditations, would know the twists and turns in your meditation and know exactly which way to go and how to do this, because you had your mindfulness together with the wisdom. So it's not just being mindful, it's having the wisdom there as well, which is why at the very earliest stages of this meditation retreat I said that insight is the path to peace, and peace is what happens when you practice the insight. Now you literally find that you cannot get into deep meditation just through force. You have to use wisdom power and also mindfulness power. The two together, mindfulness power and wisdom power, are the tremendous powerful combinations. But I would also add, along with wisdom power, the most important factor of wisdom power is compassion power. And compassion power, the kindness. Because if you're not kind to your body and you're not kind to your mind, you will find that you'll get tense and you won't have the peace, the ability to get into deep meditation. Very often I remember I tell my mindfulness, I program it, I keep doing this. I tell my mindfulness, mindfulness, be kind. Mindfulness, be kind. Mindfulness, be kind. And if I do that, again, my meditation gets so much deeper. I'm programming myself to always be kind, because it's amazing. Buddhists, they're so kind, you know, in their daily life. They're kind when they get to come to the temple. They're kind when they're eating and they look after each other. When it gets to meditation, you're not kind at all. Stupid me, come on, try harder. And you don't forgive yourself, you've had a bad meditation, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. And your kindness very often stops at the meditation cushion. You're hurting, you're in great pain, and you think, no, I'm going to push through this. You would never ask anybody to endure such pain, except yourself. You don't treat yourself like you would treat others, which is the biggest problem. In that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I told a great story which illustrated that. I think many of you may have heard that story, so it won't have such an impact. But when I tell that story in the West, that has a huge impact, because it's a story which brings up a defect in people's way of looking at themselves. And it's a story of the seven monks meditating on kindness, loving kindness, in a cave. So imagine they're somewhere in the forests of Malaysia, in a deep cave, probably around the Ipoh area. There was monks, seven monks, meditating on metta. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be at peace. May they not be separated from what they like. They were doing loving kindness meditation. Now in that cave, these were the seven monks. Listen carefully. There was the head monk, the abbot, the boss. Number two was his brother. They'd both become monks. Number three was his best friend. They'd all become monks together. Number four was his enemy. Even though there were monks together, they had a personality clash, as sometimes happens. Even though they were both good people, sometimes they grated up against each other, as happens in life. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old in years that they expected him to die at any day now. That's how old he was. And the next monk was a very sick monk. He was so ill with this disease and that disease that no one knew who was going to die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was what they called the useless monk. Whenever he tried to meditate, he'd always fall asleep, and even worse, start snoring. When he tried to chant, he'd always lost his way and would chant out of tune. He couldn't even keep his robe on properly. And he slurped his food, and he could never even learn the sutras. So he was the useless monk. And in Australia, I always say, every monastery has at least one. So he was a useless monk. Now, even though they were all different monks, they all loved each other and looked after one another as best they possibly could. But one day this gang of thieves, bandits, they found that cave in the middle of the jungle, and they wanted to take it over as their hideout, as their headquarters, because it was secluded, as you know, places where monks they usually are. And also they could hide all of their stolen goods in that cave until the heat was off, and then they could go and sell them. It was a perfect place as a hideout, but they decided they'd have to kill all the monks first. If they let the monks go, then surely that one of them would tell the police, and it would be hopeless as a hideout. So they wanted to kill all the monks. That's how mean and cruel those bandits were. But the head monk, as often happens with head monks, they become very good talkers. He managed to convince the head of the bandits, and don't ask me how he did this, he managed to convince them to let all the monks go except one, who would have to be killed as an example to all the rest to shut up, otherwise the same would eventually happen to them. And that's the best he could do. And so the head monk had to make this terrible decision, like sometimes we have to make in life. His decision had to be who would die so everyone else could go free. And who do you think he chose? Before you answer, I will go through the list again. And if you've heard this story, or if you've read it, please shut up. So the monks in the cave were the head monk, his brother, his best friend was number three, his enemy, who never liked him at all, was number four. The fifth monk was a very old monk, who's about to die anyway. Same with number six. He was so ill, he was ready to die. And the seventh was a useless monk, who throughout his whole life had done no good karma for anybody. So who did he choose to die? Now most people over in the West anyway, and probably here in Malaysia, if you hadn't heard this story before, would say he sacrificed himself, which is the wrong answer. But I'm always fascinated why everybody says he sacrificed himself. The answer was that his love towards his brother was no more, no less than the love he had towards his best friend. He loved his enemy exactly the same, no more, no less. Old monk, sick monk, even the old useless monk, he loved everybody equally. And most importantly, he loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. He did not distinguish between himself and others. In fact, he loved everybody so equally that he just could not decide. He could not make a decision because he loved everybody exactly equally, including himself. Now the reason I do tell that story is because most people, they love others more than they love themselves. We're kinder to other people and we're cruel to ourselves. We'll forgive others things which we'll never forgive ourselves. And that comes out in our meditation. When we don't let go, we don't forgive, when we're not kind to others. When we will sit long hours in meditation in great pain, we tell anybody else, don't do that, take a break. But ourselves, we force, because we're not kind. And so when I program my mindfulness to be kind, it's very, very, very effective. Because I find the biggest of those hindrances is not sensory desire, not karma-raga, or karma-chanda rather. The biggest of the hindrances which you have is ill will. It's fascinating, but it is. And the reason I know that is because every time I get stuck in a stage of meditation, I remember metta. I just have loving kindness to this moment. And almost immediately, the mind becomes more still and goes into a deeper state of meditation. Because I knew that I was not being kind. It is our nature to keep pushing. Pushing is not being kind. Force is not gentleness. So if you program your mindfulness to be kind, you get into incredibly deep meditations. Just like, for example, watching my breath. I realized a long time ago I'm not very kind to my breath unless I deliberately practice metta towards it. Breath go in, breath go out. I actually order my breath. I treat my breath like a slave. Until I realized about metta. Do you treat your breath like a slave? Is it yours to command? Do you own it? Many of you think so, which is why you can never get into deep meditation. The breath becomes afraid of you. It's just like I read in the papers, even in Australia, just how some people had abused Indonesian maids terribly. Because they think that these are just slaves or servants to beat and do whatever you wish with. Remember, your breath is not a slave. It's your friend. It's your equal. And when you respect your breath, it gets very soft and easy. So very often when I'm watching my breath, I remember to practice loving kindness towards my breath. Dear breath, lovely breath, how are you doing today? Do you want to go in or do you want to go out? How do you want to go in and go out? Do you want to spend time with me? What do you want to do? And when I love my breath, I never lose it. You know, sometimes I've had some business to do in shopping malls. I hate going malls. You know, the monks aren't really supposed to go. They were not supposed to go shopping. But every now and again, somebody's opening a restaurant or something, and I've got to go in there to sort of bless it. And so quite every now and again, I have to go in these shopping malls. And it's the same shopping malls throughout the whole world are the same. There's so many shops, so many people. And I see these mothers go in the mall with a bag in one hand and the baby in the other hand. I don't know how she balances it. But one thing I've never seen a mother drop her baby in the shopping mall. Have you ever seen that? Why? I've never seen a mother go into a shopping mall and leave her baby on some counter somewhere and go home and forget it. Oh, where did I leave baby? You know why? Because the mother loves her baby. But I've seen many people go into their meditation and drop their breath somewhere. They leave it somewhere, they don't know where the hell they've left it. And why is that? Because you don't love your breath. If you had metta towards your breath, you would never lose it. No more than you would lose your own child. Do you get the picture there? You know, one of the first times I decided to do metta together with breath meditation, to combine the two, somebody asked that question in one of the sheets, can you do metta towards inanimate objects like a breath? Yes, you can, and it's powerful. I decided doing metta towards my breath. Dear breath, may you be well and happy. You want to go in slow, you want to go in fast, rough or smooth, I will love you no matter what you ever do, breath. The door of my heart is totally open to you. I just got such powerful meditation that night. And that was one of the nights you dreamt. I was dreaming of deep meditations all night. That was really some of the nicest stuff I'd ever done. You were blissing out all night in your dreams. And you woke up in the morning perfectly awake. It's really powerful meditation from the very beginning. Simply by doing loving kindness with your breath, you came together with your breath, you couldn't lose it, you got very still, very powerfully concentrated, and you had a wonderful time. So be kind, because the biggest hindrance most people have is ill will. Keep pushing themselves, never being satisfied, always wanting something else. Loving kindness means you're happy where you are. Now when you're in love, you're happy being with what you've got. And it means you don't have to rush out the door. So that's using loving kindness together with your breath meditation. And it also means that after your meditation, there's no such thing as a good or bad meditation. You never get frustrated at all in your meditation practice. So you've fallen asleep. And after you just say, oh, I must have needed that. Oh, you were really restless thinking about all sorts of stuff. And you think, oh, I must have needed that. Never mind me. You're never critical when you do loving kindness meditation. Because it's that criticism, that judgmentalism, which is also the big problem in meditation. I was a scientist. Somebody once asked me, as a science question, which I turned around to use as a great idea for developing deep meditation. They quoted a man called Lord Kelvin. If any of you remember your high school science or engineering, Lord Kelvin was a British engineer and philosopher of science. He's now mostly known for the Kelvin scale of temperature, which starts at absolute zero, minus 273 degrees centigrade. But he also was a philosopher. At the start of the Industrial Revolution, the beginning of technology, and he said an important rule which push technology forward. He said, if we want to control nature, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first. If you want to control nature, you have to learn how to measure her accurately first. And so science spent a lot of resources getting standard measurements of length, of time, of weight. And from there, you can actually start technology, which we know today. But when they asked me that question, what do I think about that? Being a perverse monk, I changed it around. And I said, that's such a profound statement. If you want to control nature, you have to measure her accurately first. What happens if you give up all measuring? It means you can't control anything. It means you have to let go. And that gave me a way of letting go. Not measuring. And that's what loving kindness is. Loving kindness, metta, never measures a person, never measures an event. It loves a person no matter who they are, without measuring whether they're good or bad, ugly or pretty, fat or skinny. You love them without measure. And that made another beautiful avenue into the deep meditations. So I program my mindfulness not to measure, not to compare. And when I stopped measuring and comparing, it meant I had no levers to control my meditation. There's nothing more I could do but to let go. So there's no such thing as a good or bad meditation for me anymore. I'm saying in the middle of the meditation, I was sleepy, I was restless, I never measured it at all. And because I never measured it, it meant that I couldn't do anything. You know, if it's a bad meditation, you have to fix it up. You have work to do. If it's a good meditation, it can always be better. Again, you've got work to do. You do something and the doer inside of you keeps on working. And of course that means you never get still. But when I thought to myself, I'm not going to measure at all. If I'm sleepy, it's just a result of causes and conditions. Nothing to do with me. It's not my will. I never did this. And if I'm restless, it's just causes and conditions. Nothing to do with me. If I'm healthy, nothing to do with me. If I'm sick, nothing to do with me. So I don't measure. When I don't measure, I've got nothing to do. When you've got nothing to do, you just sit here absolutely still, without interfering with nature. When you do that, you get incredibly peaceful very, very quickly. Because when you don't measure, you just cannot control. So try that in a meditation when you're sitting down there. I am not going to judge or measure at all during the meditation. I'm not even going to say this is peaceful or this is distracted. I'm not going to measure at all. This is just this. Or, as the Buddha told Bahia, In the seen, there is just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. The cognized, just the cognized. The known, just the known. Without any measure of good or bad, peaceful or agitated. Now you can understand some of the very deep ways of overcoming your hindrances. Don't measure. But you have to do that 100% if it's going to work. Somebody asked yesterday, what's the difference between Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana? I said, look, there's no difference. It's just different cakes with different icing. Same cake with different icing. On the surface they look different. Underneath, they're the same. And I remember one of the great teachings of Mahayana. It was a poem of the third Zen patriarch, who began the poem famously by saying, the path is easy for one who has no preferences. And I've just taught you Ajahn Brahm's third Zen patriarch teaching. Meditation is easy when you don't judge, when you're not making comparisons. And I know why that happens. Because you're not making comparisons, you're not making preferences, you're not judging. It means you don't do anything, you can't do anything. There's no levers anymore. The steering wheel has disappeared, which means you let go. You've got no choice. And because you let go, remember this simile I said at the beginning, Ajahn Chah's leaf simile, a leaf on a tree only moves because of the wind. You take away the wind, the leaf will get slower and slower and slower until it comes to stillness, because the natural state of the leaf is absolutely still. It's only the wind which makes it move. You are the wind. You get involved in meditation, you do things, you make the problems and the difficulties, you get out of the way and you become totally still. I've said the same point time and time and time again over the last 6 or 7 days, always from a different angle, but I always call this a trick of meditation. You can sit and watch the breath, you can do metta meditation, scan the body with vipassana until you die and get not very far. You can get so far but you come across a brick wall, you can't go deeper. One of these days you're going to learn how to let go, whether it's through programming your mindfulness, whether it's through not measuring, whatever it is, you're just going to give up controlling. And you're going to find everything happens brilliantly, beautifully. And now you know what meditation is. Before the Buddha became enlightened, as a bodhisattva, he did a little test to see whether he had enough parami to get this amazing attainment. He put his bowl, his arms full, in the river Nirmala, and he made a determination, if I am to become enlightened, may my arms bowl flow against the current. And of course it did. But that wasn't just an omen, that was also an understanding of how enlightenment happens. Going against the stream of craving. And what does that mean, against the stream of craving? It means letting go of all wanting. Being still, not moving. However, it's such a hard thing to do. Craving for enlightenment, craving for jhanas, craving for nimittas, craving for peace, craving for something. That's not going against the stream of craving, that's going with the stream of craving. Doing things like just making peace with things, being kind, being gentle. Doing things like not measuring, so you can't do anything. Just leaving things alone, letting things be. That is going against the stream of craving. And if you can't do that now, one day you will. In a classic story, I'll give you two classic stories. One I will recommend you try. The other one, no, don't do it. The one which I recommend you was Ananda's method of enlightenment. Because Ananda, he was the attendant of the Buddha for, how many, I think 25 years. Listening to all the great talks of the marvelous teacher, sitting next to the Buddha while the Buddha gave a talk, and these people became enlightened, hundreds of people became enlightened, And after 25 years, he wasn't enlightened. Just like poor Mangala over here. He's been attending on me, not just this retreat, but many retreats. And imagine that he's been attending on me, and I told him that all the yogis on this retreat have become enlightened, but you haven't. And the next retreat, the same. And the next retreat, the same. And he thinks, oh no, you know, when is going to be my chance to become enlightened? You can imagine what Ananda felt when the Buddha said he's about to die. Oh, I've blown it. All this attending business, and I haven't really got enlightened. Everyone else has, but not me. It's so unfair. I've done all the work looking after the teacher while everyone else has been meditating and enjoying themselves. I always have to wait for my lunch and my breakfast until you guys are all finished, rushing around getting Ajahn Brahm cups of tea and water and stuff, and I'm not enlightened. And poor old Ananda, he got very miserable. And he just gave up, okay, I'm not going to become enlightened, that's it. But then what happened after the Buddha passed away, Mahakasapa decided to have a big conference for all the monks. Because he wanted to gather all the teachings, which, you know, one monk may have heard one, but other monks hadn't. So he wanted to gather them all together. And also just to make sure everybody knew what the rules are for monks and nuns. So he had this big conference. And Kassapa, as you would expect, invited just the arahats, the enlightened ones. But someone said, well look, Ananda, he's heard so much. Even though he's not enlightened, I think we should invite him too. So they agreed. 499 fully enlightened arahats. And Ananda was the odd one out. Imagine what you would feel. If I said we're going to have a conference tomorrow, and inviting all of you who are arahats, except you, you were the only one who wasn't. Oh, that hurt so much. So Ananda, that night he never slept. He walked meditation, sat meditation all through the night, trying everything to become enlightened. He really gave it everything, 100%, to try and break through so he could deserve going into the meeting with all the other arahats. And of course, what happened? Nothing. When the dawn came up, he was still as unenlightened as he was when he started meditating at sundown. So frustrated, he tried so hard, he'd given it everything. So what he did, there was still a couple of hours before the meeting, so he decided to take a nap. He went to his room and lay down. And according to the story, that before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. And then, just to prove his enlightenment, he deliberately arrived late for the meeting, after they closed the doors, so he came in through the keyhole. That was cool. That was awesome. Because otherwise they would never believe him. And they realize, ah, a 500th arahat. But how did that happen? It should be obvious. He was trying so hard, striving, putting forth effort in the opposite direction of what leads to enlightenment. He wasn't letting go at all. And he strove, just like that story of the donkey. He was running so hard after that carrot or durian. You could never catch it. But then he just gave up. I'm just giving up. I'm not going to even try. What happened? Before his head hit the pillow, the durian came into his mouth. Because he let go, then he became still and saw the Dhamma and became enlightened. Does that tell you something? The other story, you can actually try that. Many have been trying that many times, another method of enlightenment. So when you go and take a nap and you say, what are you doing, you lazy thing? I'm just trying the Ananda method of enlightenment. So the other story was one of the nuns. And this poor nun, she'd been meditating, I think it was 7 years, and never once was calm or peaceful. Well, that gives a lot of reassurance, doesn't it? Because this was a fully ordained bhikkhuni. with the great teachers, all the resources, 7 years she'd been meditating and not once being peaceful. You know, many of you have done much better than that. There's probably one or two of you here been meditating for 7 days and still not found any peace. But then she thought to herself, what's the point of carrying on? And if I can't be peaceful, what's the point of being a bhikkhuni? But then she did not want to return home. In those days, the bhikkhunis, they used to say they'd abandoned the three crooked things. This is just the metaphor they use when you leave the home and become a nun. You give up the three crooked things. And the three crooked things are the follows. The first crooked thing is the broom, which you use to sweep the house. It's a symbol of housework. So when you become a bhikkhuni, you give up housework, the first crooked thing, you know, the broom you use to sweep. And the second crooked thing you give up when you become a nun is the ladle you use to cook with, you know, the soup spoon. In other words, it's a symbol when you become a bhikkhuni, you give up cooking. So those are the first two things the bhikkhuni gives up, the first two crooked things, the broom and the ladle. And the third crooked thing which a bhikkhuni gives up is the husband. You can work that out for yourself. So she did not want to go back to the three crooked things. But she couldn't stay as a nun, there was no peace. So what she did, and I do not advise this method of meditation, she got a rope. She climbed a tree. She tied one bit of the rope to the tree and the other one around her neck. Don't try that. But she was just about to throw herself off and hang herself when she became fully enlightened. That was cutting it close. But often say, why did that happen? Because at that last minute she totally let go. She gave up. That's why she became enlightened. She let go. I remember another lady, she's not here today, but she was on one of my retreats and she was meditating a lot, trying to get deep meditation, not getting anywhere very much. And then the retreat was over. We formally finished the retreat. It was about an hour before the bus was going to come and take her to the airport. So she was just killing time. The retreat had finished. She just sat in a corner and meditated and got her first deep meditation. And I always like that story, because for the first time all retreat she wasn't trying. She said she was just kidding, tired, nothing much to do, so just meditate. It's not going to work, hasn't worked yet, so no chance of anything working. She just meditated and then she got very deep. And I tell those stories to you because they indicate what you're supposed to be doing and why it is that you may be meditating for many days and not got deep at all. Because you've been measuring, controlling, trying to do things. One day, take that chance. Just totally let go. It is scary. I agree it's scary. It is very much like in the middle of the traffic. You take your hands off the steering wheel of your car. And your feet off the pedals. You just freewheel. And you think you're going to crash. It's all going to go wrong. But you try that in meditation. Do it 100%, not 99.9. My goodness, it works. You let go. You get so peaceful. And you realize, I was making the thing move. Effort just makes a stronger sense of self. We all know from Buddhism that we're trying to overcome the sense of self. To let go of the sense of self. To realize anatta, non-self, emptiness. And the only way you can do that is to let go and stop doing things. So that's mindfulness for you. And programming it with wisdom. So that when you are not just mindful, but you know what mindfulness is supposed to do, programming it, adding wisdom to it, learning how to let things go, then you become very wonderful meditators. And not just wonderful meditators, it becomes so pleasant and so easy to do. You don't struggle anymore, you just sit here and everything happens. When you struggle, you just make it worse. You relax and everything becomes still. So this is actually the way of meditation. I just programmed you very powerfully. I'm not sure if my brainwashing is stronger than all your experience. But hopefully, I'm making headway, and little by little, you too will let go. Thank you for listening. And now all these questions have suddenly appeared. You haven't been letting go. There we go. First question. You shared second jhana stage, submerge into water. Doctor tried to wake him up from stillness. Okay, I wonder whether the person who's gone into jhana knows what others did to his body. Okay, this was the stories I said about the fellow over in Perth who went into such a deep state of meditation that they took him to a hospital. They even put defibrillators on his body. The other monk I was saying, he was not a monk actually, pre-monk, he went over to the jungles of Java, meditated, got into a jhana, and he was submerged in water. No, they didn't know anything which was going on to their body at all. In other words, they could not feel any sensations, they couldn't hear the sounds of the ambulance when it was going through the red lights, taking this guy to hospital, couldn't even feel the defibrillators on his body, shocking his body with strong electric shocks. He couldn't feel them at all. It was wonderful. Now, I had to learn how to let go of my body very early on when I was meditating in Thailand. Because there was just so many mosquitoes, you know, in the forest there. And we would sit meditation outside in the forest about 6 to 8 o'clock in the evening, just when it was dinner time for the mosquitoes. And look how much exposed skin you have as a monk. Your whole shoulder exposed, your arm, your head. You've got some protection with your hair. This is no protection at all. As I used to say, a monk has more seats at the dinner table for mosquitoes than you have. And there was no mosquito repellent, there was no nets, there was nothing to actually protect you. And Ajahn Chah would come and sit with the monks outside. He would sit so still for a couple of hours, and every time I would open my eyes, I wanted to run away because the mosquitoes were biting me so badly. But you know, he was sitting there and everyone else was sitting there. You know, as Westerners, we're very proud. You know, I'm not going to run away if no one else is going to run away. It was torture. So, together with a fellow American monk, we ordained about the same time, we'd count the mosquitoes on our arm. Just as a bit of a game to see who got the most. But you know what happened? You get to about 70 or 80 at a time, and then you couldn't count anymore because they were too close to each other. You couldn't actually distinguish them. You couldn't resolve, you know, the bites. Now, I'm not exaggerating, that's how bad it was. And for a Westerner, that's the other thing, that the mosquitoes came to Westerners, of course, because, you know, it was the first time in that part of Thailand they had Western food. You know what it's like, you know, the first time you get an Indian restaurant in Kuala Lumpur, everyone goes there. No, it's new, it's novel. So this is the first time they had Western food in that part of Thailand. And I'm sure that many of the mosquitoes, they went to see their friends, hey, there's Western food at this place, come along, taste some. But the problem was, it was just so hard to bear. So the only thing which I could do was actually to let go of my body. And you would do that. The mosquitoes actually taught me, look, stop messing around in your meditation. Just focus on your breath, really let go, become so peaceful, your whole body disappeared. And that was just wonderful, because that way that you wouldn't feel any mosquitoes at all. And you just have a beautiful, blissful, peaceful meditation. To this day I thank those mosquitoes, because the alternative to being, you know, to being deep inside was to have this incredibly irritating feeling which you could hardly bear. So thank you, mosquitoes. That's why I call them Ajahn. Mosquito, they're my teacher. They helped me learn how to meditate. But of course, once you get into that meditation, you can't feel the mosquitoes, you can't feel anything. So you don't feel the body, but you feel the mind, the sixth sense. Deep inside, blissed out, perfectly awake, but not noticing the feelings in the body. I remember Ajahn mentioning that you meditate in the crooked, funny posture when you admitted to the hospital. Does this mean the meditation can be done in any posture? Yes! Any posture you can get into deep meditation. Because that was when I had that scrub typhus, and you know, I mentioned about the nurse built like a water buffalo stabbing you because they could never actually inject you because the needles were too blunt. You know, having a fever for about 2 or 3 weeks and I just no energy left at all. and you get depressed. It's just the nature of the mind that when you get very, very low energy and nothing is very working, you feel terrible. But, you know, I was had enough understanding of Buddhism that one afternoon I was laying in my bed feeling really terrible, you know, just no energy, sore bottom, everything was aching, and thinking, come on, I'm a monk, meditate. So I could not sit up cross-legged. I just could not do that. I didn't have enough energy to do that. So I was lying wherever I happened to be, started watching the breath, focusing on it, just with kindness, and letting things go, and I went into a very, very beautiful meditation. Very, very deep, so you couldn't feel your body again. And when you're in hospital with a fever or with pain, oh, it's such a relief to go to a place where you just cannot feel your body at all. That was bliss. And so I blissed out for I don't know how long. When I came out of my meditation, I was just so wonderful, just having joy and happiness for a change, having a bit of energy. And then I remember looking at my body, and it was an arm one way, an arm the other way. I don't know how you managed to stay so long in such a position without moving. And it was the most weird posture I've ever seen. But I just got into a very deep meditation. So I realized from that, the postures aren't important. It's just what you do with the mind is important. So just find a posture which is comfortable for you. And that's good enough. The other thing, which I never realized this at the time, but I know after by talking with Ajahn Chah, because he used to have malaria fever. Now most of the monks of those days had malaria, because you know that's just what happened, being in the forest. And he got so bad one day, and he decided again to meditate into it. And he used to describe to the monks getting into this incredibly powerful deep state where he was really in the very, very middle. He said it was like being in the middle of a forest fire. He could feel the fever, really intense, like burning. But he was in the middle where it was really cool and still. And it got hotter and hotter and hotter until it exploded and he never got malaria again. Brilliant. And I often think that that scrub typhus, that was probably the moment when it disappeared. We got into deep meditation, and the deep meditation is too strong for things like fevers and bacteria or viruses or whatever. And probably that was the time when it disappeared. But I never connected the dots then because I was too young as a monk. So not only does it give you incredibly deep, powerful states of mind, and also a relief from the suffering of the body, but also does a huge amount of healing. So any posture works. And I'd also mention on passing that sometimes when you're meditating, when you get into some deep meditation, your body starts to move and twist. Because I always remember this one woman over in Perth, Australia. When she was meditating, I opened my eyes and I was really concerned because she was twisted around just like really, really badly. And I thought, that must really hurt. So I had to wait until she came out of her meditation. And I took her aside and said, look, I just watched what you were doing in meditation. And I can't do that. You know, I just break my bones. But, you know, it's something like this, but you know, multiply it by two or three. I said, was I? I said, yes. And how do you feel? Wonderful. And then she told me how she had a very bad injury years ago. And of course I realized that when you get into deep meditation, your body moves and twists in whatever way it needs to do to get the energies going to those places which really require it. She had to twist like that to get the chi running in the right place. Because of the injury, many of those channels were blocked, which is why she felt so wonderful afterwards. And from that time on, I've often noticed people meditating, bent over, or sort of really weird postures. And I've always found out afterwards they felt brilliant. They felt so relaxed afterwards. Pains which were there for a long time had disappeared. And they told me about their injuries. And I realized that when you get to a deep state of meditation, when you let go of control of the body, then the body does what it thinks it needs to do to heal itself. And it does it. So once you can't make that happen, it just happens when you're not paying any attention to the body because you're deep inside. But if your body does start to move that way, and your friends tell you, don't worry about it. It's the body just doing what the body needs to do. Since jhana is so wonderful, can I use jhana to commit suicide? Meaning to say... These are weird questions, but anyway. Meaning to say, when my body is rotting due to terminal illness, I go into jhana stage, leave my body and never want to come back to life and stay in jhana permanently. That's actually not a dumb question. It's usually the case that, you know, it's very difficult to die in jhanas, because, you know, usually you come out afterwards and you come back to your rotting body. But what you can do, each one of you, when you die, is that when you die, you'll float out of the body, just the normal near-death experiences, and then you'll see the nimitta. You go towards the light. If you haven't seen a nimitta before, you will see a nimitta then. Because that's what happens when the five senses turn off at death. You die. Which means your five senses and body turn off. And you're left with the jitta, the mind, this beautiful light. And all this stuff which I've taught you about nimittas, about leaving them alone, being still, not getting excited, not being afraid, but learning how to merge into that nimitta, and understanding the power of that nimitta is very much concerned with how generous, how kind, how virtuous you were. If you've been a very beautiful person, kind, generous, serving, not fault-finding, that light you'll see when you die will be beautiful, which makes it much easier to merge into. And if you merge into that nimitta, if you come out the other side, you'll be in some heaven realm. But if you stay in it, you'll get into a beautiful jhana realm. And if you have at least understood the Dhamma, seen the Dhamma of a stream winner, then you'll never come back. That's called in the suttas the jhana anagami. This is where you exit samsara. When that jhana state just vanishes after many centuries or eons, then you go to, you've nibbanaed, the jhana anagami. If you haven't been a stream winner and you get into those jhanas, when that jhana fades away, you'll have such a powerful, blissful, strong mind, a mind which naturally inclines towards letting go. If you get reborn in this human realm, you're way ahead of the game. You'll be able to meditate so easily. And just as long as you get reborn where there's a Buddha around or some teachings, your chances of getting enlightened next time are huge. So it's a very worthwhile thing to do. So what you're hearing here is learning what to do when you die.
Ajahn, when the breath disappears, what can be our object of meditation?
Just like when you're watching the TV, when you turn the TV off, what do you see? The screen. So when the breath disappears, what's left is the screen on which the breath was playing out. See if you can notice the screen. Yeah, it's blank. It's much more subtle, but it's there. So when the breath finishes, carry on watching the screen. And then from that screen, after a short time, a nimitta will arise. Don't go and do something else. Stay where you are. I think I'm having a nimitta blast. That's very nice. Ever since I had my first nimitta, I was cheerish with joy. But then I will have the shine in most of my meditation once I've gone into deep breath, even before I go into deep sleep. The brightness shine until I have a headache yesterday. That's nimitta headache. No, there's no such thing as nimitta headache. Samadhi headache, yes, no nimitta headaches. I also had insomnia and nightmares in my dream. I'm always in a run or caught into some sticky situation. This is what they call it inception. I don't know what that is. But I have subconsciously built my stress into my mind that I even dream it. Because this is almost the end of meditation, I will need to go back to work by Monday. Not if you become enlightened by Sunday. Now that sometimes, if you've been forcing the nimitta, working too hard, then you get the stress, then you get the headaches. Because remember, just through force, through effort, you can get so far in the meditation, but you can't go all the way, certainly not into the jhanas, through effort. You can get so far, then you come across the brick wall, you can't go any further. And if you're getting headache, it does mean that you're trying far too hard. So let go. Even if you get nimittas, it's a nimitta which is a brick wall, you can't take it deep into the jhanas. So let go, go backwards, lose your nimittas, and go another way of like letting go, being peace, and the nimitta will become far more beautiful, and also they'll be very joyful, and you'll be able to go deeper into the meditation. It's sometimes like those mazes. I remember going as a kid to Hampton Court, just outside of London. They had these big grass mazes, these bushes, and you had to find your way into the centre. And I remember many times you go on one very promising path, and it looked like it was going to the very centre, but it goes so close, and then there was this big hedge, you couldn't go any further. Close, but not good enough. So what you had to do is backtrack, and then find another path to actually go right to the centre. So sometimes in meditation you have to backtrack, because you take that path so far and it can't go any further. That's usually the path of striving and struggle and will. It doesn't get that much further. And again, if you are struggling, you get headaches, then that's also when you get some bad dreams, because it's the stress of your day you take into your sleep with you. So if you're really just letting go and being peaceful and having a nice time, of course when you're dreaming you're being peaceful, you're having a nice time, and you're having good fun. So again, your dreams are also a sign of what you're doing in your meditation. So be warned if it's like bad dreams and nightmares, and also that you are getting stressed with headaches, you're trying too hard. It's a grateful moment to learn the meditation from you. I agree. Thank you. I deserve that. Can you share with us the walking meditation? As for fast walking meditation, how fast is considered fast? Usain Bolt's speed is fast meditation. You know Usain Bolt, don't you? He's the fastest man in the world, 100 meters under 10 seconds. So if you actually do 100 meters of walking meditation in under 10 seconds, that's called fast walking. No, it's just so you get some energy coming up. But now I had a cold at the moment, so I did some fast walking this morning. It felt really good. I mean, getting some energy up, even though you feel sort of you've got a cold. Because you do need exercise sometimes. And sometimes, you know, if you're meditating, you don't get that exercise, again, the body is imbalanced. So sometimes do fast walking meditation. Find a path and just go until you start sweating. You know, so you get some exercise, your heart is beating, and the metabolism is working. Because that's always very great for actually helping with sickness. Actually, somebody actually told me, there was an article somewhere in a magazine that if you walk, I don't know, maybe an hour every day, that's as good as chemotherapy for cancers, somebody said, and far less painful. Interesting. But anyway, so a bit of exercise is really, really good for the health, so do fast walking. But if you're just doing that walking meditation to let go, again, let the body decide how fast it wants to go. So you're not doing it. You're just walking. You set the journey going. Walk to the end. Turn around. Come back again. And just so you know, the present moment awareness, the silence. You know which foot is moving. You can feel the sensations in the leg as they move, and it can get very, very peaceful in walking meditation. I used to tell the story when I was a young novice monk in this temple Wat Saket in Thailand. They had one of these huge halls, just about the same size as the one up on the hill over there. And after the morning chanting, I would stay there and do some walking meditation for an hour. And I would walk from one end of the hall to the other and back again in 1 hour, half an hour each way. That was really slow walking. And I wasn't forcing it, it was just natural. And I remember one day I hadn't finished yet. I was about 10 minutes from finishing. And I was, you know, my gaze was 2 meters in front of me, and I was, you know, very feeling the feet as they were lifting, and all these amazing feelings in the feet as they lifted. And it was wonderful, it was just so interesting and so peaceful. And then I heard this voice like a million miles away. Brahma Wang So, Brahma Wang So. And I wonder what it was. Brahma Wang So. And I realized there was a monk with his mouth in my ear shouting at me. But because he was actually that far from my ear, because I was late for Vedana. I'd forgotten I had to finish earlier, and he was sent to come and get me. And I couldn't come out. He was shouting, it was like a million miles away. And I was very respectful. I realized that I had to come out quickly, but I started moving my head so I could look at him. And it took me 5 minutes to move my head because I was just so mindful of every movement of the, and it was amazing, just the muscles in your neck and what actually happens when you actually move. And eventually, no, I faced him after 5 minutes. What? He was so cool and still, he just couldn't move fast. And it was a wonderful experience. He understood, you know, I was in a nice deep meditation. So you see, you can get to that deep state of meditation when you're walking meditation. You hear the gong go for lunch. And you turn around so slowly. That's nice.
Ajahn, you mentioned Chaga and Pratinisika, the two of the four states of letting go. What are the other two? Chaga is giving, expecting nothing back in return. Pratinisika is throwing things away. You know, Ajahn Chah, once I was coming back on arm's bound with him, and he got hold of a stick. And straight away, he said to me, "Is the stick heavy?" And it was quite a big stick, and before I could say yes, he threw it in the bush. He said, "It's only heavy when you keep holding it." Now, those were his one-liners, which are incredibly powerful Dhamma. Things are only heavy when you keep holding them. So if you're still thinking about your husband who's misbehaved, if you're still thinking about your wife who's not being kind enough to you, if you're still thinking about your job and all your worldly stuff, what to do? Go and find a stick. Get a piece of paper and write your husband's name, your wife's name, officer's name on it. Tape it to the stick and then throw it as far as you can. Psychologically, it actually helps you to let go. Because your health, your finances, your family is only heavy when you keep holding on to it. So Pratinisika is throw things away. The other one, mutti, is being free, and the meaning of freedom is being happy to be here. Even in a jail you can be free as long as you have to be in jail. Freedom is wanting to be here. If you want to be somewhere else, that is called prison. And many of you are in prison in this Wat Chetawan during this retreat. You put yourself in prison many, many times. By which I mean, you don't want to be here, you want to be somewhere else. That's called prison. So if you understand, when you want to be somewhere else, you put yourself in jail. If you want to be free, want to be here. With a dull mind, with a cold, with a restless mind, in jhana, whatever you are, just want to be here, then you're free. And the last one, which I never mentioned the other day, is analia. Analia, which means nothing sticks to you. To use modern jargon, it's having a Teflon mind, which means I call you a pig and that doesn't stick to you. I call you the best meditator in the whole retreat and that doesn't stick to you either. Nothing sticks. That's called letting go, having Teflon mind. I better keep going quickly because there's a couple more to go. Uh-oh. Three more to go. Okay, turn that one. That one, yes. You like a Jagannisika, yes. It is sometimes challenging to be present and still. How much of the present does one accept? Everything, you've got no choice, it's already here. That's why the present moment is really important. What are you looking for? Got one over here. Sorry? Sorting out, okay, very good. There we go. How much of the present does one accept? 100%, everything, because it's already here. You've got no choice. You have to accept it. Here it is. So this moment has come from its causes and conditions. And if you reject it, you're rejecting the reality of now. You're trying to fight something which you can't win because it's already here. This present moment. So you totally accept everything which is here. If there are noises outside, constantly noting it too much disturbs, but noting it, but not noting it is not being present. No, of course it's not. How do we strike the balance? You don't note anything.
If you note it, you're not in the present moment, you're noting something which has just finished happening. So all noting is about the past. Don't note things, just know them. And if you know them, and know what's happening now, the sound doesn't disturb you. You just know it and it's gone. Which is why it's never the sound disturbs you. It's you who disturb the sound. The sound's here, here it is. You have to accept it, you've got no choice. The only choice you have is like it or lump it. And it's not worth lumping it. Lumping it means fighting it and just hating it. Here it is, you've got to deal with it, so just accept it. It changes by itself after a while. So the present is what we accept with loving kindness. We open the door of our heart to whatever's happening now. And the last question, could you please stress the importance of practicing meditation alongside education, i.e. the success story of your student getting a scholarship to Harvard? Yeah, because many of you may know my life story. When I was doing my final examinations at Cambridge University, this was in 1972. In those days, everything depended upon the final exam. Everything else you'd done in the whole 3 years at Cambridge counted for zip, nothing, nil. You either passed or you failed on a series of examinations at the end of the 3 years. And I was doing my subject, theoretical physics, part of the natural science tripos, what they used to call it. And you wouldn't believe just the series of exams. It was a 3 hour paper in the morning, 1 hour for lunch, and another 3 hour paper in the afternoon. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Now that was really big stress. If Amnesty International was around in those days, they would have actually taken the Cambridge University to court. That was torture. Now 6 days, even Saturdays, doing 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. So it was very stressful. And I was told by my friends, by my family, by my teachers, it was important. If you get a good degree from Cambridge, you are set for life. If only I would have known I was going to become a monk, I would not have worried so much at all. But I never knew that at the time, so I worked very hard. But I had the advantage. I knew how to meditate. So at lunchtime, I never had a meal. Had a big breakfast, ate in the evening. Lunchtime, I went back to my room and meditated for half an hour. That was so brilliant. Because when I sat down, rested, and just watched my mind, the first thing I started thinking about was the morning exam. How had I done? Did I answer the question correctly? Did I put enough explanation? You all know that the past cannot be changed. The morning exam had finished. It already probably got locked up in some safe somewhere to be marked the next couple of days. If I got it wrong or got it right, it was done, it was finished, it couldn't be changed. But why do I keep worrying about it? Because I had learned meditation, I could let it go. Very quickly, I just totally forgot about the morning exam. Most people can't do that, because they haven't trained in letting go of the past. Even though it's logical, you still can't do it. I could. So after a minute or two, I'd totally forgotten about the morning exam. And the next thing which came up into my mind, the afternoon exam. Get out the books, should I stop meditating and do some last minute revision? But one thing I noticed, and I've told this to many other students, and they agree, that when you swat up, do some last minute revision, whatever you look at 1 hour before the exam never ever comes up in the paper. Never once. It doesn't work, it's wasting time. And I realized that this was the rest time. It wasn't the time for doing examinations. And the best thing I could possibly do for the after the examination was to forget about it and rest. In other words, to let go of the fear and worry about a very important thing happening soon. I could let go of the future because, again, I trained in my meditation. So there I was in the middle of the past and the future, For me, that meant the morning examination and the future examination in the afternoon. And I was at lunch, in the present moment. That's why I call the present moment lunchtime. If you're in the present moment, you're having lunch between the past and the future. Rest, relax, enjoy. So there I was in the present moment, and the next thing I saw shocked me. I realized I was shaking, physically shaking. I realized I was nervous after all. Understandably so, because all the pressure of final examinations. But what shocked me, I had not noticed that before. The reason why? Because I was never looking at my body. I was always worrying about the past exam or the future exam. And when I realized I was nervous, it was very easy to calm the body down and relax. And soon all the shaking in the body vanished and I could really physically relax at last. And the next thing I noticed was my mind. I'd just done a 3-hour paper in theoretical physics and my brain was exhausted. I described it at the time, like, because I was an English man, like a tea bag, which had been drained of all the juice, so there was nothing left. That's what it felt like. And because I noticed how tired I was, I could just totally relax and just watch the energy come back into my brain. Until after 1/2 an hour of meditation, my brain was reinvigorated and I could feel all this energy. My body was relaxed, which meant when I went into the afternoon examination, I did really well. It was brilliant examination technique, as I've just described. And I try and teach that to my students, so that before the examination, they don't worry or study. They relax, they meditate, they let go. So when they enter that examination room, they're physically relaxed and their brain is empowered, like mine was. That's why I did very well. So I teach that to people, examination technique. And as I mentioned the other day, that one of the students who've been following my talks for a long time now in our center in Perth, he got the top student in the whole of Western Australia. And he came to thank me for all the meditation techniques I taught him and all the Dhamma as well, his positive attitude he had to life. And because he became the top student in Western Australia, he was headhunted by the best universities in the world. They all gave him incredible offers and he chose the one from Harvard. And Harvard University is number one in the world. I'm sorry, I feel embarrassed that Cambridge was number two, but Harvard actually beat us this last couple of years. With all expenses paid, scholarship for everything. And my goodness, his family was just so proud but also relieved that he didn't have to pay a cent for him. And imagine that, your child, all expenses paid, scholarship to Harvard. And how did he get that? From learning meditation and from learning the Dhamma. This is amazing, the competitive edge you can give your kids and yourself, simply because you know how to work the mind and you can achieve immense things. So that's the last question there. Any other questions from the floor before we do interviews? Oh, there's another one, there's an education. No, we've done this already. Oh, can I have them? That's right. No, we haven't. Oh my goodness. Okay, I'll do this very quickly. Kama Chanda, especially the sexual fantasies, how to overcome during the meditation. Thank you. This is actually one of the monks, when I was a very young monk, he came to ask Ajahn Chah. He said he was troubled with sexual fantasies during his meditation. He asked for some advice. And Ajahn Chah said, very easy, stand up and tell everybody what your sexual fantasies are. So whoever wrote that, would you please stand up? And you will never do it again. No, you're just wasting time. So after a while you ask, yeah, if you want to sexually fantasize, no one is going to read your mind and actually stop you. So it's really up to you. What are you here for? Are you really here just to sort of go off on sexual fantasies, or you really want to train your mind? So after a while you look at yourself and say, look, I'm wasting valuable time. So don't get down upon yourself and punish yourself, because that's another sexual fantasy. Instead, just forgive yourself and say, look, I know what I want to do. This is much more fun. As Ajahn Brahm says, better than sexual intercourse is the deep happiness of jhana. So if you really want to have some fun, fantasize about meditation.